As a relatively new radio show, it hasn't been often that I've had the chance to sit across the microphone from someone who has previously been a guest. But I am doing that today. This is Gibson Faye LeBlanc, who was one of, I believe, our guests on the very first Dr. Lisa Radio Hour in September of 2011.
Sounds right.
Yep. Talking about the Telling Room, which was your life at the time. I believe you were exiting out of the Telling Room. And unfortunately, I think we didn't get to spend as much time talking with you as we wanted. And you've been doing a lot of very interesting things since then. So thanks for coming back and having another conversation with me.
My pleasure. My pleasure. It's great to be here.
Now, Gibson, at the time you were with The Telling Room, and I do want to talk about that, but I subsequently went and listened to you read from your book, your collection of poems, Death of a Ventriloquist, which went on to win the Vassar Miller Prize and received a starred review from Publishers Weekly. Also spent several weeks on the Poetry Foundation's list of contemporary bestsellers and was featured by poets and writers as one of a dozen debut collections to watch. You've really sort of manifested in a kind of completely different and unique way.
Yeah, well, you know, I've always been a writer, but it's usually been sort of back burner for me. Teaching is really important to me as well, and I love to work with kids and adults. I've kind of taught at every level there is to teach at. And working at the Telling Room is a tremendously gratifying place to work. And I still am involved there, and I still teach there. But a couple of years ago, I had a chance to put the writing on the front burner. And so that's been exciting for me to do that. And interestingly, I've been working on this collection of poems for a long time, or several years. That counts as a long time, I think. I had been very close to publishing it in many different small presses and contests. I was finalist. I got notes from editors, effusive notes saying how much they loved it and why. And it wasn't until I decided to leave the Telling Room that it was actually won this prize and was published. And so it seemed almost like one of those things that I had finally committed to my writing, and that's when it finally broke through and was published. So it was a kind of a nice the universe telling me maybe that I had made a good decision.
Well, that is what is always said, is that once you finally focus your energies in the direction of your passion,
right,
then start that fire. It's like the magnifying glass in the sunlight.
Exactly.
So it is interesting that you were then subsequently rewarded with that happening.
Exactly.
You have your book with you right here.
Yeah.
I heard you do this at, I think it was Space Gallery, when your book first came out.
Yeah.
I was struck by the sort of range of poems. One of them was, I think it was describing your child. Well, it was describing fatherhood.
Yeah.
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 You also did a poem about hockey, which is a passion of yours.
Yeah.
I'm interested to see which one you're going to read for us now.
Yeah. Well, I thought I might read one of my fatherhood poems because many people can connect to that, whether you're a father or parent or just an uncle or an aunt, or that people can connect to that part. And there's a strain of poems in the book that come out of fatherhood and really trying to figure out how to be a father. And so this is one that I wrote while I was living in New York City, and I had just finished grad school, where really focused on writing and teaching, and then all of a sudden I was home with this baby. and my wife was back at work at finishing her residency at NYU. So we were in a 400 square foot apartment, New York City, third floor walk up. You can picture the the thing here. And this baby who cried all the time. So it was a test. And so it really became one of my subjects over the last several years. It's become something I write about a lot, is fatherhood and my kids, and thinking about that. And so this is How to Make Fatherhood Lyrical. How to Make Fatherhood Lyrical. I could describe the arc of piss as sanctifying the changing table, or argue that his wailing resembles a certain style of opera. One develops a taste for its peaks as evidence of proper training, the cultivation of a gift. I might tell you that when the dog tugs the leash in one direction and the stroller rolls in the other, it's similar to the push and pull of family and vocation, and each in turn alters its course. Surely I'd research and touch on why gerbils eat their young, and moose will charge if you dare step between mother and calf. But none of this is the truth I tell myself or don't, depending on the morning. It's not a set of lyrics, it's prose, as in pedestrian, a man on foot, not some freak stallion, not a Clydesdale, not even a draft. And every day I have to choose whether to write myself in.
How old are your kids now?
They're now 8 and 5, so they're much further along.
This really is something that I can relate to. And actually, it's funny because I was going to refer to the Ark because I had remembered that you had read that poem, I believe, at Space Gallery.
Yeah.
And this is something that I think a lot of people in the creative field struggle with, that when you're raising a child, all of your creativity kind of gets sucked over there.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
The growth that you would like to do in your own writing or music or whatever it is ends up being channeled towards these progeny of yours, and you never realized that it was going to be quite as challenging.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
And you're right. It can be so physically exhausting that you wake up in the morning and you're just lucky to get the diaper on the kid and the kid on the school bus.
Yeah, I went through I'm not sure exactly how much time, but there were a few years in there where I was not writing a lot, or I was just taking notes, or I was just in any 30-second break that I had, I was trying to get something down. But you're right, the energy goes toward the kid as it has to, you know, when you're trying to survive that early period and make sure the kid survives that early period. You know, it's a lot of work, and it's a lesson in it not being about you, being about this other being that you help create. But it's also, I found it important and great to, as they've gotten older, to make sure I make my writing a priority and for them to see that, and to see that it's part of my life, and this creative side is something that is, you know, that I really need to do, and that I've got to find the spaces of time to do. So, but it's a constant juggling act, even at this point with 8 and 5. There, I still feel like I can't quite imagine. I have writer friends who go and do the 2 week or the month away at a colony, and I can't quite wrap my mind around that yet. Maybe I think I could get up to a week at this point. I've done some stuff like that, but it just seems like a long time to be away at this stage of their development.
In the time that you were writing this poem, you were talking about it as being prose.
Right.
And really not poetry at all.
Right.
On the other side of having a very small child who cries all the time, are you able to find any lyricism in it?
For sure. I mean, there are those moments, you know, even in the middle of the night or, you know, when things just when, you know, you're about to cry and you laugh instead. You know, there are those moments, or just, you know, you're, you know, one of my sons looks at me a certain way or cocks their head in the same way as my wife, or, you know, you just have those moments of clarity in the whole process. And I think that's what poetry is really about for me, those moments, good or bad, you know, or in between. Just, you know, trying to unpack those moments and all the emotion that can be surging through you at those times.
Your wife is a family doctor, as I am, and I know that at the end of a day of seeing patients myself, I can feel the need to kind of withdraw a little bit, mm-hmm. because so much of one's energy as a family doctor, or a doctor of many different sorts, is outward going, mm-hmm. listening to stories and trying to help create a sort of a healing situation, dealing with paperwork and administrative. But at the end of the day, I know that I will sometimes feel the need to kind of draw in and not want to solve problems necessarily.
For sure.
And
yeah.
not want to, you know, and it's very challenging.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
What has that been like for you and your family?
Yeah, it is. Being a family doc is a really challenging, I think it's one of the more challenging jobs. I put it right up there with principal of a school or, you know, any job that requires you to be in charge of all these people who are, you know, you're involved with their welfare. And it is, it's outward, it's all outward focused. And I find that in our house, I mean, sometimes I wonder how my wife does it, how Renee does it, you know, coming home and sort of being ready to sort of flip the switch and go right into, you know, hear about our kids' stories or all the things that they want to tell her that they've been saving up all day that sound different when you tell your mom versus your dad, you know. I think she's found her own spaces where she can withdraw and recharge. She's a big runner, so that's one of them. She'll, you know, go out early in the morning or at night sometimes, and that's a place where I think she's able to unwind. I also try to, as the dad and husband, I try to make as many decisions for her as I can when she comes home, because I think that's part of it, is you make decisions all day long that are real important decisions that affect people. I think she comes to a point where she can't, you know, she doesn't want to decide about anything, dinner, you know, anything. It's just like you want to just kind of sit back and relax and withdraw. So,
well, because we're talking about Renee and her job as a family doctor, I would like you to read this poem that you wrote called Explanation, yeah. Beginning with a River.
Yeah. Explanation beginning with a river. Swimming in a thin print dress among piranhas, that year you learned a place I can't fathom. In a jungle 3,000 miles away, you watched sea turtles bury their eggs in the dark. You gathered bitter cassavas, drained their poison for days to make bread. You have patience now. A woman drips with toxins. A guy in a Johnny chases you down the hall, cursing for opiates. You have this place you go to. I can shake the sky for nighthawks and parse the bark puzzle of a London plane. It doesn't matter how many other people I talk to. At home, I listen to the pipes thrum inside our walls. I don't know how to be alone.
And again, that's something that I can really relate to, because I do think that there's something very interesting about being in a relationship with somebody who's in medicine. And it's not just the when you come home at the end of a day, it's the many days where you don't come home at all.
Right.
And
for sure.
Your family is at home waiting for you, and not just your family, but the man that loves you. Mm-hmm. And then there's this deep loneliness and this idea that being a doctor, it can be very all-encompassing for a family.
For sure. And it's, I mean, like I said, I think it's one of the harder things to do in the world. And I think for Renee, it's her passion too. So I think both of us, since we met, we've wanted each other to follow our passions and to try to make the space for that to happen. And so for me, that's been writing and teaching. And for her, that's been being a doctor. And but it does. I mean, I think there's definite trade-offs, you know, and that's part of the decision making that we went through as a family when I decided to leave the telling room. It wasn't just about writing. It was also about both parents in the family not having these jobs that pulled them constantly away from home. You know, writing is a job that where you can be sometimes someplace else in your mind, but I can do it anywhere. And so I can be present in our kids' lives in a way that she can't right now, because it's just not possible, you know. So for her, I think she has to have these moments where she's able to disengage from work and come home and be with the kids. But it is hard, because sometimes there are periods where it's really not possible, or where she's really working a lot, or on call or on service at the hospital or involved in different things. And it is all encompassing. So, and we talk to our kids a lot about that, you know, why their mom has a job like that. and so that they try to can maybe understand a little bit about what she does and why it's important.
I think you embody or represent this sort of new man. You're like the man of our generation. I mean, you are a poet and a writer, an educator and a father, and you have a professional wife. You're also a hockey player and a musician, I believe.
No, not so much with the music, but
not so much with the music.
The other stuff I'll claim.
The other stuff you'll claim. Okay. And I think this is what we have all thought that we would aspire to, you know, after the equal rights movement. We all thought, well, men and women are equal and right. We could all go out and we could all have everything.
Right.
But there's certain challenges and
For sure. I mean, there are some things that I feel like, you know, there are a lot of things that come much more naturally to me as a dad, and other things that I really have to work at. you know, I don't know how much of it is related to me specifically being a man, or, you know, it's always hard to track what that stuff is. But certainly some pieces of parenthood or fatherhood come a lot less easily to me, especially as I'm doing work that is, you know, at least traditionally was thought as being a woman's work, you know, in our house or with the kids, or going to PTO meetings, or, you know, things like that that aren't traditionally seen as being man stuff. But I mean, I feel lucky to be able to do it, I feel like a lot of fathers still in our culture miss out on a lot of stuff in their kids' lives, and aren't able to see a lot. And so I feel privileged to be able to be a part of their lives and to see what's going on. But there are definitely times when I'm also saying to my sons, you know, we better wait till mom comes home to deal with that one, you know. And there are certain things that they just aren't going to want to, they're just not as quick to open up to me about, or, you know, they still really, you know, there are times when they really, the comfort of their mom is, you know, I can give them comfort, but it's a different kind of comfort. I'm a little bit more willing to sort of let them do things that I think Renee would say, well, what are you doing? You know, diving off the couch, or I don't know, something. There's some things that I sort of let things go a little farther often. And, you know, I think that there are times when that's good and times when maybe it's not, but.
But you're making it work.
Yeah, yeah.
You also spend a considerable amount of time with other people's children.
Right.
You were involved in, I believe, a year-long project with a local school here in Portland, which was very much invested in bringing arts to the children in this school.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Yeah. Well, my oldest son goes to Ocean Avenue Elementary School here in Portland. He's just finished the second grade, and so he's just been there for 3 years. And as I've gotten more involved with the school, I wanted to see more of a focus on arts. Having been involved with the arts community in Portland through the Telling Room, I know how great it is and how many great teaching artists there are and people who are really working on their particular craft, whatever it is, and are really also gifted at bringing that to kids in a way that, you know, even a great teacher is still a teacher in a different way than an artist who's coming into a classroom. It's just two different things. And so I really wanted to see more artists in the school. And I noticed over time working being involved with the PTO and being at the school, that there are also this, just in our school community, there are these great artists who are parents, who are sort of this resource that the school wasn't drawing on. I think we have one parent who's a dancer and a longtime teacher of dance at the PATHS, that the high school, the Portland Arts and Technology High School, and another parent who runs a local music program for kids where they do rock and roll. So, you know, there's some things that we decided, okay, let's see if we can get some of this stuff into the school. So I was able to write a grant to the Arts Commission, and we were able to get some funding to help support those programs, and we're hoping to do it again next year. But it's a great way to get these artists in front of kids, to open up school a little bit more. I think whenever you do the arts, it does a couple things. One is it brings more kids into school, like into being interested in school in a way that often doesn't happen. So there's, you know, those kids who are already figuring out, even at first or second grade, that school is not for them. And doing, you know, dance or a performance project or songwriting or, writing comics for a school magazine, you know, those are things that aren't often valued in school. And so to value them in the school community is huge for those kids. And then the other thing is I also really wanted to see that great community moment where you've got kids and artists and parents who all come together and celebrate the arts and say, this is something that's important to us. And so we had a night at the end of May where we were able to do that. We had 400 or 500 people packed into this cafeteria at the school, and we had kids up there singing songs they wrote, dancing, reading things that they wrote. And it was just a great, great community moment. You know, we often do that for sports or other things, but we don't do it as much for the arts as we should, especially at the younger ages. So it was really a really good way to value, you know, to show how our community can value the arts and be changed by the arts.
You've had a broad variety of experiences in your life. What's next for you?
I'm trying to finish the novel that I've been working on for a few years pretty intensely, which is, you know, one of the writing project that's taken the most of my attention since I left the Telling Room. And hopefully I'm getting closer. I have a new draft that I'm just finishing up here, that I'm going to put in front of some friends who are writers who can give me some thoughts on, you know, where it is. And then we'll see. You know, I'm going to still, I'm going to continue to be teaching at the Telling Room and doing things at Ocean Avenue and probably other schools, because that, to me, I can't, even though the focus for me right now is more on the writing, I can't not teach. It's really important to me, and it's important for me to feel connected to my community, and to feel like I'm giving something back to kids who, you know, might be interested in the arts in their lives in some way, or who just need to see directly what the arts can bring to their own experiences.
It's almost 2 years since you left the Telling Room.
Yeah.
And the Telling Room has been around for?
5 years before that, so they're going on 7, 8 years. Yeah.
What has the Telling Room brought to Portland and the surrounding community?
I think it's really filled a really important niche. And there's a great arts community in Portland and southern Maine, and there's pockets all over Maine. But there was nobody focused on writing and storytelling and kids in the way that the Telling Room has. And so I think that's the reason why the growth curve of the Telling Room has just been kind of crazy and ridiculous. You know, it's just been straight up pretty much since I started there. When I first started at the Telling Room, they were just getting off the ground, and I was working out of my living room, and, you know, it was very part-time, but we knew we had something, this great idea, and people were already starting to get really interested in it. And as we started working with kids, it just, you know, the more and more people that saw what we could do with storytelling in kids and writing, the more it's grown. And so, yeah, it's really been, it was a tremendous thing to be a part of, and it's also tremendous now to sit back and, you know, be involved, but from more of a distance, and to sort of watch it continue to grow and develop and push into new arenas. So, and I think the Telling Room has become like some other arts nonprofits, like Space Gallery or some other places, has become now at this point kind of like a vital cog in the arts scene, something that people can't imagine doing without, which is, I think, a testament to all the folks and all the many folks who were involved there. So,
Gibson, your book, Death of a Ventriloquist, is available at Longfellow Books here in Portland. How can people find out more about you and your writing?
I have a website, GibsonFeyLeBlanc.com, and they can check out poems and hear about things. I have something on there called The Sentence Project, which is a little pet project where I pick out favorite sentences from prose and poems that I'm reading and just talk a little bit about why I think they are interesting or why they work. And there's they can also see more information about my book on there and order it through Amazon or different or the independent booksellers, etc.
Thank you for bringing the arts to the children of the city of Portland and surrounding communities through the Telling Room. Thank you for bringing your poetry to the airwaves with us this morning. I really appreciate taking the time to talk with us. We've been talking with Gibson Fay LeBlanc, poet and educator and father.
Thanks for having me.